Good morning.
Good morning.
A couple things. First, I will likely forget I brought this up here, so like, sorry, and I'll come back or bring it to me. But I felt like that little tickle that was like, maybe she needs water. Also, before I get started, a little vulnerability. I'm exhausted today, and I felt the need to, my tongue is not feeling as lively. I picture myself like getting lost in my words. One of my kids last night decided a 7:30 bedtime needed to be 10:30, which meant that all the things I had planned after meant an 11:30 bedtime for me, and then I just couldn't sleep. So I'm just being vulnerable with all of you, because I'm sure you've all had those days when you're supposed to show up in a certain way, and you're like, ugh, it doesn't feel like it's there. So thank you for being a group that I trust to say that to this morning. For those of you who don't know me and are like, who is this woman just spilling her guts when she's supposed to be giving a sermon? My name is Rachel Rogers. I use they and she pronouns. I live in Nashville. I am an aspirant to Unitarian Universalist Ministry. It has been my absolute joy to be a regular preacher here in Murfreesboro for the past, what, three-ish years now at this point. And I came to you with opening words that of my own, really, that reflect a bit of what was just shared by Betty, because the first thing written on my page is, happy almost spring. I hope that you are noticing the day is stretching a bit longer. I am noticing tiny buds on some of the bushes in my yard, around my home, and I feel very grateful for the change in the seasons. Spring has historically been my favorite season. My oldest child was born in early April, and the real root is likely that my birthday is just over a week after hers. I'm a spring baby. The anticipation of newness and warmth is a comfort to me and typically has me looking forward to new things. These past couple of years, though, the past three, coincidence to be exact, not you guys, just what was going on 3 years ago, it feels like the strict opposite of my classic spring feelings. Feelings of dread and worry and anxiety that doesn't quite seem to have a center. Just a general concern that something is about to go wrong. The onset of this change in my spring vibe was the pandemic. I remember on the first anniversary of when lockdowns began, I wondered several times out loud how long it would be or how long it would take for spring to stop carrying the weight of those memories. How long it would take to untangle the light of spring with fear and uncertainty and that awful not knowing that consumed us about every decision, from whether or not it was safe to shop for food, to what kind of face mask was the safest this week, to whether or not we felt comfortable giving someone a hug. The confusion of that time, and I'm sorry to remind you, was endless. Everything was turned upside down. Right and wrong no longer had clear definitions on so many topics. We were all so exhausted and so frightened. I still don't think many of us have processed the trauma of that time. And some may feel like that period hasn't ended at all. So this spring feeling, this anxiety that's crept up on me the past few early Marches, because it was March 13th was the day that I got sent home from work and thought I was going back in 2 weeks, right? It's a trauma anniversary. The phenomena of trauma anniversaries is very real. Trauma anniversaries mark the return of a date or season in which we endured a trauma in the past. According to the National Center for PTSD, trauma anniversaries impact us because of the way that our memories store our traumatic stress. We can feel trauma anniversaries in our bodies even if we aren't conscious of them in our minds. Now, this means that even if you haven't thought about the anniversary of the start of COVID-19 lately, sorry if I ruined that for you, you may still have experienced what you have interpreted as unexplained anxiety. Now, while of course I would never generalize or proclaim that everyone is going through this, I do believe, though, from my own experience and from witnessing the experience of others, that trauma anniversaries are worth paying attention to. And since the pandemic and subsequent lockdowns, on top of the incredible loss of life that we witnessed and felt, we experienced a collective trauma. And I don't think it's too far off the mark to assume that there are plenty of these feelings going around. Now, I'm starting to feel like a downer, but I promise we'll get there. At the same time we are entering this season of remembering, we are also facing compounding atrocities and oppressions in the world. I am currently blessed to preach more often these days than I ever have been. Not only does this mean that I'm getting the chance to be in conversation and in community with other Unitarian Universalists across the Southeast, but it also means that I am building up a muscle around preaching sermons more often. And lately, it has been hard to approach a pulpit on Sunday without worrying that this broken record of concerned thoughts in my head and my heart aren't influencing a broken record in my speaking topics. I was a little bit late in getting Jill the title of my talk last week because I was trapped in the state of discernment about exactly what I was going to talk about it or how I was going to talk about it that would differentiate this week from another. Because just like the last time I was with you, and the time before that, I feel that the state of the world demands our attention, and its effects on our emotions and mental health are things that we cannot ignore. So the way that I choose a topic to share in church typically starts with paying attention to what is happening in my life, to the things that are moving my spirit, to the topics that come up again and again and start to tell me a story that help me sense a need, whether in myself, those around me, or all of us. And typically, it's many of us at the same time. And so that means that during these last weeks, it has been all but impossible to put together talks, sermons, or even interpersonal conversations that aren't focusing on how we best ease the pain of these times. When global citizens are under siege, when gender nonconforming students are losing their lives, quite possibly at the hands of other students, and most definitely after living in a hostile environment, fostered by the very adults charged with ensuring a safe place in which to learn. On the periphery of all of this, there are the voices of this year's presidential election, which grow louder and louder every day. All of these things combined would be enough to send someone, me, into a state of anxiety or even despair. But of course, I haven't even mentioned the stressors that occur in our personal lives, the stresses of jobs, strained relationships, financial hardship, kids who won't go to sleep, like anything that could beleaguer any of us. And so honestly, my friends, this leaves me worried. Worried about how we're all doing and how we are all finding ways to stay present to the difficulties in the world while also caring for ourselves. Because, and I do want to be clear here, we do need to be actively taking care of ourselves. It is at our own peril that we barrel through without giving thought to how we should be doing this. And even if we scan our bodies and our hearts and find that we're not suffering at this time, that we are not burdened, I still don't believe we have the option to simply ignore our own mental and emotional health. I think regardless of how we're feeling on the day, we still need to pay attention. We need to stay close to it, to develop an awareness and to make choices day by day that allow for care. I would go so far as to conjecture that not a single one of us has the luxury of not paying attention to it, because we're not immune. I think each of us would benefit from a practice where we wake up each day and we ask ourselves, how you doing? What do you need? And then intentionally adjusting our plans for the day to include accommodations, boosts, and remedies for our mental health and our emotional well-being. Now, I mentioned before that the sermons I preach or the talks I give spring up from whatever topics my spirit calls me to pay attention to. And this means that there is typically a personal narrative that accompanies the choices I make on this front. So, not surprisingly, I come to you today fresh on the heels of my own period of examining my personal methods and practices around caring for myself in difficult times. When things get hard for me emotionally, it starts to feel like everything is pressing in on me. If I'm not spending time in reflection, the stressors and the business of my life have me starting to feel like I don't have the opportunity with any regularity at all to just be. Distracting internal messages signaling the threat of overwhelm will start to get louder and more intrusive. My fuse will grow shorter. My threshold for unexpected changes or demands will become very shallow. Now, naturally, these types of internal storms will start to stamp out any natural inclination to check in with myself or to follow the practice I mentioned of adapting my daily schedule in order to accommodate how I'm doing. Because, well, of course it does. And because the entire problem I'm typically experiencing is that I'm going through, worried about, or feeling deeply, like it's drowning out most of my other thoughts. So I want to distract myself. I don't want to dwell in it. I want to look away. This tendency to almost instantly forget my own advice can be infuriating to me and can even be a source of shame that I need to combat. This is that second arrow I know I've talked to you about before. The first arrow being the pain you feel, the second arrow being the pain or the shame or judgment you experience over feeling the first emotion in the first place. This cycle can compound upon itself very easily. First you feel bad, then you feel bad for feeling bad. And before you know it, not only are you suffering over what was happening in your life in the first place, but now you're suffering from your own self-judgment. Buddhist psychology refers to this state as being in the trance of unworthiness, which is a state that pulls us out of the true awareness of the present and into a distracting and painful story we tell ourselves that tries to teach us that we are undeserving of feeling any better than we do right now. It can be incredibly helpful in our daily lives to develop a practice of recognizing when this is happening. If we can get familiar with the concept of that second arrow and its tendency to pull us out of productive, calm, or healing energy, it can become easier to interrupt it. Instead of, you are unworthy or unlovable because you are a miserable person, we can start to think, uh-oh, there I go again, telling myself that I should feel ashamed for feeling bad. This isn't a true story. It's just one that keeps me from figuring out what it is I need to do to feel better, because I do deserve to feel better. So this is the first strategy for facing difficult times that I would offer you this morning. Do what you can to develop a muscle around recognizing that experiencing feeling bad about feeling bad, and then have a strategy for interrupting it. Remind yourself that feeling distress over a difficult circumstance is not a sign of weakness, that no matter your age or the amount of work you've done to overcome older tendencies within yourself, the fact that you feel pain or feel burden means, it just means that your heart is awake. That this period of pain is not a reason for shame, it's actually a source of life. Most of us have been called to recognize at this point in our life that we speak to ourselves in ways and render judgment upon ourselves in ways that we would never thrust on other people, especially those we love. Interrupting and stopping that second arrow of shame can be a revolutionary step towards building a practice of treating ourselves the ways we would want those we cherish to be treated. And if we can remove that self-inflicted layer of shame from our current struggles, that offers us just a little more space to start cultivating a love-filled frame of mind from which we can offer more healing thoughts and work towards ourselves, more healing thoughts for ourselves and for the world. So, what are some other strategies for moving through these moments and seasons of difficulty? I'll tell you mine. First, I have a call list. This is like my squad. It's a very small group of people that I have cultivated trust with over time, who know my history, they know my stories, they know my trauma anniversaries, my triggers. They're people I've been in a relationship with for long enough that they have seen plenty of my ups as well as my downs. So when I'm telling them I'm down, they know that I'll be able to go back up. They are the people I trust to see me and to reflect back to me what they see and offer real support to me in difficult times. As a person whose lived experience includes plenty of periods of struggle and work on mental health, I know what it looks like and feels like to truly be in the thick of it, even to the point of crisis. Crisis begins when the pain you're experiencing starts to preclude your ability to participate in your daily life as normal or to uphold the commitments and responsibilities you've made with others. So because I know what it looks like and feels like to be in the down deep, I have also developed an awareness at this point of what it looks like to be on a path towards that place. So my strategy for using the call list is to deploy it before I am in crisis, or even before I am near in crisis. When I see shadows looming, or have found myself having to deflect that second arrow consistently without real success. So I use it before things get bad, at the first real sign of danger. Now all of our lists will look different, and they do not necessarily include those that you are most intimate with on a daily basis. For example, While many of those who are partnered would notify our partner first, like number one on the phone tree, I wouldn't say as having that person be your first call is requisite. So this is me trying to shield off that arrow when you're thinking, well, I wouldn't want to call my, I'm not going to say that on a recording, that I wouldn't call my wife. I would probably not, actually. Not first. She knows that. Because it could be that that second arrow of shame has you worried about letting your partner know that you're struggling because you don't want to burden them. It could be that they're also struggling, they're treading the same waters, and that their capacity is also low. It could also be they're a source of some of your suffering and your stress, and that's okay. Your call list probably includes a few people you have a deep, long friendship with, those that you mutually care for, offering help when they need it and accepting help from when you need it. They should be people who don't make things about themselves, those who aren't reactive. Those who know you well enough to know what you need, either through experience or because you've had the confidence and the forethought to tell them what you need at times like this. Your list could include a sibling, a mentor, a therapist, a trusted coworker, and not all people on the list need the same level of detail. What you're doing by making yourself vulnerable in this way, maybe kind of like what I did at the top of this talk, is by sharing what you are struggling is quickly and deftly weaving a safety net. Oftentimes, in my experience, activating your network will go a very long way to shield you from that second arrow and can even help diffuse a time where mental space is lacking quickly, preventing you from ever getting to crisis at all. For me, activating the call list looks something like this, a text to my dearest and longest friend that says something like, "Hi, I love you. I'm struggling a bit with life right now, and I just wanted to tell you." That's it. And I am very blessed that his response is usually swift and casual with something like, "I've got you, and I love you. Let me know if you want to talk." It's a simple exchange, but one that instantly creates space. I'm no longer alone. I'm no longer hiding. If you don't have a friend that you can do this with, and you think there might be someone who'd be willing to be this person for you, ask them maybe sometime if they'd be willing to be that person for you. "Hey, when I'm struggling, sometimes I just need to tell somebody. Release the pressure valve. It doesn't mean I want you to fix me. It doesn't mean I want you to manage me. Just like say, 'Gotcha. You want me to call you later?' And that's it." I'm pretty sure you all have people that would do that for you if you don't already trust that they would. And I know for me, just knowing I can do that just helps me motor through the second half of my day because I know that Gray has got me, he's heard me, and I'm not isolated in what's happening for me. Now, my call list also includes my therapist, which could be its own strategy, I guess, just therapist. And I want to say hooray for skilled professionals who can objectively guide us through these times. Now, if I don't have an appointment scheduled, I'll make one. And I'll also do that to create a space to intentionally process what I'm moving through or whatever difficulty I'm facing. If we already have an appointment on the books, I will send her an email letting her know what I'm facing, just taking the time to write through whatever is trying to grind the gears of my life to a halt. Again, just trying to create some space. So that's a couple, those are the calls on my call list. There's a few other after that. It may not be a therapist, it could be a spiritual director, it could be a mentor in your life. Like I said, it could be a sibling. My sister's up there pretty high. But usually after I've reached out to a couple of people in my support network, I'll start to feel the pressure lift a little bit, right? Because I've called them before I'm in crisis. I've called them because I know things are getting hard. So it doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take hours long of sobbing on someone's shoulder at this point. It's okay if it does. But what I've done is I've been proactive about it. So now I've employed two strategies. I've recognized and called out that second arrow of shame. Wait, no, I don't have to feel this way. What am I going to do to stop feeling this way? And now I've activated that call network, that list, because I found myself deserving enough to ask for help. I've not only offered myself love, but I've taken steps to ensure that I do not feel alone. Now, the next step in my personal practice of navigating difficult times is just taking a look at my current suite of spiritual practices. I was recently reminded to do this by a mentor who I was in conversation with after that recent exercise of activating the call list. She asked me what my current spiritual practices were, and I was like, I write every morning, I have a meditation practice, I try to do it 4 days a week, and then I'm like, the shame is in. I'm like, I try to do it 4 days a week. I mean, sometimes it's 3 times a week, but like 5 days, you know, and ooh, stop. And she nodded and she listened to me and she was like, "What's missing?" She asked me what I was doing to get out of my own head. And then again, the shame is there. I'm like, oh, are my spiritual practices not enough? Are these not right? Were they, like, not spiritual enough? Like, it's just... But at that moment, before I could go too far, she was like, "I've recently taken up knitting again. I thought that was helpful." And I was like, "I knit. I do that." I almost shouted it. I was like, I was on a Zoom, and I was like, "I just finished these socks." And like, lifted my shirt. It's like, "I did it. I have one." And she... Bless her. She said, "There you go." She was like, "A spiritual practice is anything you are doing to intentionally help create more space in your heart and in your mind." And I loved that. That took me off the hook. You know, no one could really claim that meditation is not a spiritual practice. I don't know why I was going that route. But, you know, you think that they need to be some sacred moment. She's like, "No, whatever you do that creates more space for you, that is a spiritual practice." And there it was again. It's all about making more space. This takes me to the third strategy point. After you've started working to combat negative self-talk, after you've let others know you need support or may soon need support, you need to make sure you are taking part in practices, whether you call them spiritual or not, that do that, that help you create more space in your mind and in your heart. You need to prioritize these practices. Being very preachy, you need to either schedule them or place reminders about your home or workplace to participate in them. For me, that means keeping my current knitting project within my line of sight in my den. So I keep it, it's usually socks, so it's small, so it's under the TV on the mantle. Like, if I sit down, I'm like, "Oh, that, I'm gonna go and do that." It means keeping a book next to the bed. It means leaving my meditation mat out on the floor after I finish a session, so I think about it next time I walk in the room, instead of rolling it up and putting it in the corner. It means scheduling a massage if that's healing for you. It means taking walks. Scan through your list of personal practices. What are the hobbies you have that leave you feeling the most clear-headed, the most calm, the most connected? Find a piece of paper and write those things down. Perhaps just under that list of names that make up your personal call list. You now have taken steps to develop a safety plan. A way to proactively prepare for a time of difficulty. For those of us who experience them, even a time of crisis. Just knowing it exists can be a comfort. The last strategy point I'll mention here is probably the one I need to be reminded of the most often, and that is to slow down. It is very much okay to back off some of your commitments during difficult times. I promise. We are all allowed seasons of rest and restoration. Also, many of us tend to fill our calendars with activities, places to go, and things to do, often for others. And these are all good things. But if we are hurting, if we are struggling, we cannot take the time to faithfully employ the rest of our strategies for coping and healing if we don't get a break. You can imagine, as busy as you know me to be, that this is the hardest part for me to manage on this list. When the world is pressing down on us, when we are facing a new difficulty or the anniversary of an old one, we owe it to ourselves now and to ourselves in the future to learn new ways of being that include taking a beat, taking a breath, and slowing down. Multitudes of activity can be helpful to distract, certainly. And I'm not even saying that it's always a bad idea to do so. But what I do know is that if we don't find strategies to create more space for ourselves, and most often, things will get far worse before they improve. As I move to a conclusion today, I do want to acknowledge that I trust that most, if not all, of these notions are not new to you. They are not new to me either, by any stretch. But I also know that very often I need reminding of all of them, and so that means that you may too, especially in times like these. In times such as these, when the world will not slow down, and when we do have so much work to do, as our reading referenced today, so many people in this community need us to be fighting for justice. And that means in order to continue to do the work, we do have to remember ourselves. So that is my hope today, that you are all remembering yourselves and your needs, and that you are all either skilled at or focused on getting better at offering yourself compassion. I know that you deserve it. And I pray that you find the space to do so. May it be so.